Hello and welcome to Media Talk. Coming up, end of the giveaway. Rupert Murdoch closes the freebie London paper. Plus, on the media frontline in Afghanistan, can the government really ban the reporting of major news stories? And what's in store at the Edinburgh TV Festival? More on that story later. I'm Matt Wells, and this is Media Talk from The Guardian. In the week that ITV announced the return of The X Factor, we have two of our own reality stars to guide us through this week's podcast. Stephen Brook is the press and publishing correspondent and deputy editor of MediaGuardian.co.uk. What's your act, Brookie?
Well, my act? Singing James Bond theme songs.
Excellent. Jane Martinson is editor of the print edition of Media Guardian. Will you be requiring the services of the podcast in-house psychologist this week?
Yes, always.
Okay, we'll get her on standby. Good, let's get underway. And at the time of podding, news has just broken of News Corporation's decision to close its giveaway free sheet, the London paper. It appears to be part of Rupert Murdoch's decision to stop giving away his stuff for nothing. Earlier this month, he confirmed plans to start charging for News Corporation's online content. Does it signal the end of the road for free newspapers? And what was behind, and indeed who was behind, the decision? Stephen Brook, what's your first take on this story?
Well, it's definitely a first take because it's only just happened. I think there's a number of factors here. Free newspapers have been shutting all over the world, particularly in Europe. Metro International has been sort of pulling back from lots of different territories. And I think free newspapers have been particularly hard hit in big cities where there's been competition, i.e. London. So I think that for a long time, News International and Associated have been sort of dancing around each other, trying to come to some sort of peace deal on this to stem the multi-million pound losses that
because
both have suffered.
In London, there are three free newspapers in total. There's the Morning, Metro, and then there's the two that go head-to-head in the afternoon, Associated's London Light and News International's London Paper. Has the London Paper ever made a profit?
No, it's lost money. I think the last figures were sort of upwards of £16 million.
And that was in the year to 2008, before it became really, really grim.
Yeah, and now in the middle of the recession, you can only wonder, with the collapse in advertising on all newspapers, just how much worse they were doing.
Yeah, the London paper is really interesting, Jane, because it was really influential in London. I mean, I would say that it was the catalyst that informed the relaunch of the Standard as a more positive paper. Because when the London paper was launched, it was bright and breezy and said that it would have a more positive outlook for London. And that's really, if you look at the Standard now, it looks like the London paper looked, 2 years ago.
Well, it was only in January, when, I don't know if you remember, that they took out a full page ad in the London paper where the editor, Stefana Hatt, said thank you to all its readers for proving such a success that the Standard's relaunch made it look just like the London paper. In terms of how it's changed the media in London, it's been incredible. The battle, almost all other sort of arguments, the sale of the Standard, the rise of Metro, the future of Associated and the sort of difficulties they're facing, and in fact News International, has been dictated.
Yeah.
And you could almost say that the decision that Murdoch has been talking about recently, to start charging for online content, would not have come about if the company as a whole, it would have come about, but perhaps not at this particular time, if the company as a whole has not been, pouring, as Stephen was saying, more than £10 million a year out on this free paper. I mean, astonishingly, though, in terms of the long term, I don't think anyone would have put money on Rupert Murdoch being the first one to say, to call a halt.
Because he's not a quitter, is he?
Well, also, particularly with this fight seemed to be stacked in his favour when Associated sold the Standard and sort of carried on London Light becoming this sort of shadow of its former self. It was sort of a matter of time. People kept. I remember it was Associated who first went to News International and asked for some sort of deal. Did I mean, Stephen, you'll remember this. That deal where they wanted to basically share distribution, try to cut costs. It's been a killer to try and compete, for these two newspaper groups. In London, one capital, one city, they've been throwing all this money away. But for Murdoch to actually blink first is incredible. It does show that he's incredibly commercial. I mean, he closed today, he's proved that he will do it, but still.
I think we've got to wonder what James Murdoch thought of the whole thing, and Rebecca Wade.
Well, now, Rebecca Wade is the interesting factor
incoming,
in all this.
Or Rebecca Brooks, as she will be known when she takes up her new job at the start of September as chief executive.
So remind us about her role.
Well, she has been editor of The Sun for the past 5 years and I think has been no fan of the London paper, and probably quite correctly feels that Free Sheets have been damaging to the circulations of other tabloids. And I think that, coupled with the whole fact that, as we've been saying earlier, Murdoch now wants to charge for websites, meant that it was more likely that the Free Sheet would close. Because the whole idea about it was to take on the only successful Free Sheet in Britain, which is Metro, which in the good times would make about £8 million a year. But it was able to do so because, A, it was a monopoly, and, B, it had this contract on the London Underground, which meant that its distribution in the mornings was very cost-effective, and you could just put it into these dump bins.
Yeah, so yeah, it was dump bins, whereas the London Paper and the London Light employed phalanxes of staff to stand outside tube stations.
Yeah, I don't think that was originally part of the plan. I think the plan was that one of the companies wanted to get the afternoon,
because there was going to be an afternoon contract.
Underground contract, yeah. Which Associated actually gave up. But once the competition was on, then who wants a London Underground contract with dump bins if you've got rival distributors handing out your rival copies outside the tube station before you get in?
Jane, what does this say about the broader picture of free versus pay generally? Because it does seem that free is going out of fashion.
Well, I mean, the interesting thing is, as Stephen talked about the timing of this contract, what's sort of amazing is we were all waiting for that contract to come along. Metro has made a lot of money. I mean, Metro has actually, and it's true what you say about the freebies closing around the world, but Metro has been a phenomenal success.
In Britain, so.
Yeah, it's you know, the circulation figures, it's made money 10 years, you know, it's coming into its 11th year. But with this tube contract coming up, everybody thought before today that that's what both News International and Associated were waiting for. I mean, now it suggests, I don't think it heralds the end of free. I think free is still a successful business model. And given that the way the newspaper market is at the moment, with everybody looking for ways to make it work, I don't think it's the end of the free. I do think we cannot maintain that sort of vicious competition in a small market like that.
All right. Interestingly, James Murdoch, who, as we were saying, that oversees all of News Corporation's interests in the UK, is delivering the James McTaggart Memorial Lecture at the Edinburgh TV Festival next week, so we'll no doubt hear more about this then. Media Talk will be there, of course. We're recording next week's edition on Sunday, August the 30th, so there'll be no edition on Friday. It'll be a few days later. But we're at the festival in front of a live audience. If you're a delegate, make sure you're up for 10 a.m. on the Sunday. But if you're not a delegate and you want to come along on August the 30th just to see us, then we can arrange a free ticket for that session only. Email us at mediatalk@guardian.co.uk. Now, if you have emailed already, look out for your confirmation reply soon. More details on all of that at guardian.co.uk/mediatalk. And we'll be talking to the director of the TV festival, Amy Brown, later in the podcast.
Media Talk with Matt Wells on guardian.co.uk.
In an attempt to boost voter turnout for this week's elections in Afghanistan, the authorities in Kabul have been orchestrating a controversial media crackdown on accounts of Taliban attacks. Their reasoning, to try and prevent people being put off voting. The Guardian's correspondent in Afghanistan, John Boone, explains the restrictions.
Well, the way they're trying to do it was by issuing a very late-in-the-day order to all domestic and foreign media, simply telling them that if they report on violence or security incident, they should expect to be shut down if they're Afghan media, and to be asked to leave the country if they're foreign media. The statement was issued by the Ministry of Foreign Affairs, but it was actually a very high-level decision taken by the country's National Security Council, who I'm told took exception to some foreign media reports, particularly in the broadcast media, that were suggesting that some of the attacks on Kabul in recent days amounted to the sort of violence that, you know, last seen in the 1990s during the Civil War. And that sent them through the roof at a time when everyone's very anxious about turnout and trying to encourage as many people to go to the polls as possible.
And has it had any effect at all?
Well, most of the Afghan media and the couple of groups that represent Afghan journalists immediately said this is outrageous, this infringes our basic rights to free speech and the constitution and the media law, and we're going to ignore it. I haven't seen any statements by foreign media, but I mean, talking to fellow journalists, I think we were all determined to report what happens when we hear about it, and I think most of the coverage has lived up to that.
So it's being widely ignored, then, it seems. What is the media like in Afghanistan? Is it a thriving media? What is the scene like?
Well, it's certainly thriving. I think it's one of the, you know, the little sung success stories of Afghanistan in the sort of post 2001 world. There's a huge number of daily newspapers and TV stations and radio stations.
And is it something approaching a free press, or are there, as we've seen this week, quite tight government controls?
Well, there's a constant pull, and I mean, the media organisations, particularly the most outspoken ones, are constantly running into troubles with the government or with officials. Sometimes that will manifest itself as a legal case hitting them on some other spurious grounds, when in reality the problem is they've upset someone. And then a lot of Afghan journalists have a problem with the insurgents. I mean, obviously there are large parts of the country where it's dangerous to operate. The Taliban has a very savvy media operation. They take their messaging and their media operations very, very seriously. A couple of months ago, the head of one TV station was actually abducted for a couple of days by some Taliban militants who, by all accounts, treated him well, but gave him a grilling about balance and bias in his broadcasts.
John Boone on the line from Afghanistan there. Stephen, I mean, going back to this ban that the government was trying to impose upon journalists, I can't imagine particularly the foreign media taking much notice of it.
Well, I have sympathy for the Afghan government, which is, in this case, probably trying to act with good intentions, but it's really media management 101. Don't tell journalists. Don't try and ban journalists from doing something, because they'll go and do it.
And if there's a big car bomb, you know, you just can't sit back and not report it, can you, Jane? I
mean, and it also smacks of sort of trying to kill the messenger rather than actually try to deal with the situation. You know, you turn immediately to say, "Oh, it's because you're reporting it." Well, actually, no, it's because it's happening.
Interesting that John was saying that the media is the success story of Afghanistan.
Yeah, it's actually a few rays of light coming out of the region at the moment. And I mean, on the other side, I've also heard that the sort of what's been happening in terms of the Western media, the BBC's role out there has been really interesting. You know, it's been there for 76 years, just launched a local language service, got this swanky new headquarters in Kabul. It's been described by John Williams as the West Wing, the sort of current West Wing of the world, with so many, you know, special advisors and senior correspondents from the world's media organisations out there.
Indeed, thank you very much. There's more up-to-date news, of course, on the Afghan elections at guardian.co.uk/Afghanistan. Let's take a look at some of the other media stories making the news this week. The X Factor's back. Very exciting. Now, you didn't go down, Stephen, to the launch, did you?
But I didn't, but I've been talking to my colleague Lee Homewood, who said that money oozed out of the TV screen whilst it was on. Yeah. So it looks like that's where the ITV drama budget's gone.
Yes.
Into producing a newer, more sensational X Factor. I think what we're going to see, actually, is quite a different programme, and that's for two important reasons. One is that they're going to have a Sunday night programme, like Strictly Come Dancing did, the results show.
But they've just dropped because it wasn't working.
It did, yes, but it didn't work because it was pre-recorded, whereas ITV are going to have a live Sunday show, so they're all going to be back for that night.
Yeah, that was the problem with the Strictly Come Dancing thing.
You got a sense that it was pre-recorded and it was a bit of a flop. But Richard Holloway, who's the executive producer of the show, is, for him, live is everything, and he thinks that's just intrinsic to the program's success. The other thing they've done is that they've taken a leaf out of what I think is sometimes has been the best bits of Britain's Got Talent, which are the auditions. And what they've done in times past, they just had a closed studio with the four judges, and that's it. They've actually opened that up, so there's a live audience now for each act as soon as they walk through the doors. Which means
it creates a whole new live show, doesn't it, in effect?
Basically, there'll be you get audience reaction, and If you look at the sort of US versions of America's Got Talent, there, the crowd is pretty rough and ready and makes its opinions felt very quickly.
Makes much more pressure.
Yeah.
This was the controversy, Jane, of the last series, wasn't there? There was too much pressure on the people who took part.
And which is why, I mean, you know, after following the Susan Boyle farrago, Richard Holloway this week, you know, announced that they would be having the on-set psychologist, you know, they're taking the duty of care very, very seriously.
Well, they've got to say that, haven't they?
They've got to say it because, you know, increasingly it appears that the vulnerable people are being, if not used, then certainly are appearing a lot more than perhaps they used to.
That is true, but I would say in defence of the program, having been up and attended one of the X Factor auditions, these people,
were you on stage?
As a contestant, I was there as a reporter.
Right, in a professional capacity.
Yeah, in a professional capacity, these people desperately want to be on it. And it's fascinating because they walk through the door and you can't in some circumstances tell whether they're going to be brilliant or a nightmare.
Well, Susan Boyle.
Yeah, exactly, exactly. The whole case, and
well,
she obviously
that's what makes her a brilliant program.
Yeah, came under a lot of pressure, but not really just from the program, frankly, because the media had a lot to do with staking out her hotel and pestering her.
In other showbiz news, we don't take showbiz lightly on this podcast. New 3AM website. Well, I think this is really interesting because it's really good.
It's fantastic. Because what's so interesting about it is that, you know, for all this time, the only news out of Trinity Mirror has been negative.
And their websites have been rubbish.
Yeah. And I mean, you could argue, if one were to be critical or forensic, as we should be, that this is making a virtue out
of
Media Guardian. It's practically our USP. That you could say that this is making a virtue out of necessity. You know, that they've been losing, revenues have been falling sharply. Regional business is really suffering. The website, you know, that Trinity Mirror have not been in the way that others have. But now what they're doing is saying, well, actually, we have a strategy not to chase ABCE numbers. We don't really want foreign readers. We've got this other way of trying to make money from, frankly, our own specialist subjects. So football, yes, fantastic for the Mirror. Celebrity gossip. Mm. I mean, if the Daily Mail can do it,
yes.
You know, there you have 3AM, it's already there.
Yeah.
And sort of trying to get, you know, games and other ways of making money, sponsorship.
And the design is very interesting, isn't it, Stephen? Because they've got this woman who I now, of course, I should really do my research, I've forgotten her name, has come from Heat Magazine Online, hasn't she?
Heatworld.com.
Heatworld.com.
And her name, Matt, is Isabel Moen.
Right, I knew you'd know.
I've done the work, so you don't have to.
Thank you. So Heatworld, that's not the same. Is that the same as Heat Magazine Online? There's nothing to do with Heat Magazine Online.
Yeah, no, it totally is. But what they've
and
done...
So it looks a bit like that, and it also looks a bit like Paris Hilton, which I do read.
Yeah, and what you'll find, or what you won't find, is content from the Daily Mirror on the site.
You won't find?
No,
really?
You won't. And there's no branding for the Mirror as well, because let's face it, you know, 3AM in the gossip world is probably as famous a brand name as the Daily Mirror is.
And it's got a very arch kind of tone to it, doesn't
it? Yeah, it's
which again
fun.
Isn't Daily Mirror.
No.
And, you know, one of the best things, if you want to read more, instead of read more, they've got care, click here. And there's also a separate section where you can rate celebrities. You can push them up on the A list or push them down to the Z list.
I love that idea.
Yeah.
Stephen spent all of yesterday playing.
It is the silly season, I'll say in my defense.
It's sort of a cross between, it's like a cross between Marina Hyde and Lost in Showbiz and Heat Magazine, isn't
yes.
it?
Yes. Really and there good. Is actually a serious point about the SEO thing. I think they've...
This is search engine optimization.
Sorry,
trying to up your Google rankings.
Yes.
They don't care about this, apparently.
Yeah, their strategy is not to go for that. And you can sense the sort of very committed, Sly Bailey business ethos. We've got to make money out of this. They want to be able to go to advertisers and say, look, we've got an audience. They're British-based. They're the people you want to advertise to. They're not coming in from Google Japan to look at photographs of Cristiano Ronaldo's smashed car and then exiting immediately. They care about the site. They're on it for a lot longer than people are on equivalent sites, and they're the sort of people you want to reach. So that's the business case that's behind both Mirror Football and 3AM.
Very much led, I think, by Richard Wallace, the editor, and his editorial team. isn't it? I mean, I don't think this has sort of come from on high. He's been very sort of keen against the sort of, we don't just follow Google SEO.
Yeah. Well, back in the day, Richard Wallace, of course, invented the original 3am column when Piers Morgan was
and
the editor.
And I have
editor.
To say, it's sort of started in print to go a bit stale, as you know, as everyone else has copied it, isn't it? So it's really interesting that they've sort of tried to leap ahead here. In serious news, Don Hewitt, who is the creator of the iconic current affairs, US current affairs series, 60 Minutes, has died. This was a groundbreaking show, wasn't it?
It was, and for a whole number of reasons. It started in 1968, and he'd basically been demoted. He used to run CBS Evening News and got sort of pushed off into special projects, and he came up with this. It was revolutionary for a whole number of reasons. It created stars out of the correspondents. It was revolutionary because it was on at 7 p.m. on a Sunday evening, and it was revolutionary because it became an immensely popular and powerful program.
With a famous TikTok theme tune.
Mm. Yeah, and then because of its power and because it topped the ratings for 5 years, it got world leaders on, and it was a great mix of gung-ho investigations and interviews. There was a famous Australian version which interviewed Margaret Thatcher very early on in her prime ministership and said, well, you're obviously doing a lot of good, Maggie, but you're pig-headed. Her reaction was quite famous.
Jane, it influenced current affairs TV around the world in Britain. I mean, that's what we have to thank for tonight with Trevor MacDonald.
Well, I was going to say, you could see it as the sort of grandfather version of so many of those sort of current affairs programmes, which become, you know, prime time. And actually, I mean, it's an interesting time for it to happen, isn't it, when we're all sort of, no one can see that future for prime time, 60-minute current affairs programming, such a difficult thing, and yet, you know, there was the granddad.
Great. You can find links to all of these stories at guardian.co.uk/mediatalk. Amy Brown, the director of the Media Guardian Edinburgh International TV Festival, is here. Amy, the big draw for the festival every year, one thing we all always talk about, is the MacTaggart Lecture. It's being delivered this year by James Murdoch, who of B Sky B. What are you hoping that he'll say in the sorts of debates that he'll alight?
Well, the MacTaggart is shrouded in secrecy this year more than any other. I mean, Jeremy Paxman, I knew he was writing his at the last minute, but I had an inkling of what he was going to talk about. James Murdoch, I think we're all going to be waiting until we get in the room to know too much about what he's going to say. I know that the speech is being worked on, but it's very much under wraps at the moment.
Was there a particular reason why you chose James Murdoch?
I think we wanted to pick someone that was bigger than just television. We wanted some of the feedback we'd had from festival delegates in the past, and something that the committee very much felt was that we should be looking beyond just television on our screens and think bigger than that, and to have a speaker who reflected that. And James, of course, at News International does. There's B Sky B, but there's also the whole News Corp empire. So we felt he could take a bigger picture. And also internationally, I think we wanted somebody that had a broader picture than just the UK landscape.
And is that something that will feed over into the rest of the festival? What are the highlights that you would pick out?
Well, it does feed over into the rest of the festival. I think in the past, sometimes there have been sessions that were, you know, it almost kind of felt like a digital ghetto. And I think we've just kind of tried to incorporate new media into the sort of festival as a whole. And there are sessions like How to Make Money Online that's very much focused on how online companies do it. And it's not about how the broadcasters succeed or don't succeed in their online.
Mostly don't.
Exactly. And so we've got that, but we've also got, you know, a session that's going to have some exciting new data that they haven't shared before about the iPlayer, and also looking at you know, what's happening with viewing online. We did some research with Deloitte that was really interesting that showed, however fast our broadband speeds get, the great British public doesn't think they're going to watch any more television online, which was a really surprising finding.
Well, it's really surprising given the fact that the iPlayer does seem to be doing very well. So perhaps that will be a difference of, you know, what people expect to do and what they end up actually doing. Perhaps.
Exactly. Mm. And I think the iPlayer at the moment is very, the research was very much people are using it for catch up or if they miss something, because it's something still, the thing to me is always you have to know what you want to watch. You have to be able to find it somewhere. And so I think TV still provides the main marketing really, for people to think, oh, yes, I missed that. I must go and watch that. So there's those kind of sessions. I'm really excited about Robert Peston. I know it's a bit brainy. He's on against Peter Andre.
Robert Peston or Peter Andre?
Robert Peston or Peter Andre. It's
How
a difficult decision. And I was torn for that hour. And I'm really excited about both of them. Luckily, I sort of skip between everything. But okay, I am excited about Peston. There was that period in the year where you were just addicted to Peston. You know, it just sort of felt like every day you had to get home and read his blog or find, you know. And I think that's interesting that one man became, you know, whatever industry you're in, you had to hear what he had to say.
And he was the face of the story.
Yes.
But what about Peter Andre? Why? I can't understand. Why would we be interested in Peter Andre?
I think Peter Andre is fascinating. I think it's Peter and Katie and how initially, you know, after I'm a Celebrity, they met and then started their own shows. How they did it through their own production company, you know, through Cannes TV, it was very, I think it was very interesting just in talking to them about how they made certain editing decisions, the decisions about how much they let the cameras into their lives and how actually they did not go into the edit suite and have any say over what was shown or what wasn't shown.
And I guess why they would want to.
And why they would want to and how they've managed that. And I think now the next phase is they're both going to be having TV shows. We'll have more.
Lord save us. Amy Brown, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Amy Brown of the Edinburgh TV Festival thinks that Peter Andre is fascinating. Jane Mutton, do you think Peter Andre is fascinating?
In many ways.
I'll be looking forward to Edinburgh this year. I mean, I think there'll be fewer people there, won't there, Jane, because of budget cuts?
Well, they had. I mean, until sort of, you know, the early part of the process, they had a huge increase, actually, and loads of international delegates, apparently. Mm. I think it's going to be really good, but I don't know if that's because, as a journalist, you know, you like the idea that it's sort of, you know, making the best of a bad time.
Yeah, it'll be good to have James Murdoch there because he's in his new role. He's across all these different areas now.
He's got to be a highlight, isn't he? Yeah. I mean, it's almost going to be a disappointment whether he says because expectations are running so high.
Do you remember the last time that a B Sky B executive gave the McTaggart was Tony Ball, and it was quite possibly the worst McTaggart ever?
He came up with different though when it's a Murdoch.
Yeah, it is different when it's Murdoch.
Because obviously 1989 was one of the all-time greats when Rupert gave his. And I mean, even James has done the alternative.
Yeah.
And that, you know. That
he's not a bad speaker.
He's not a bad speaker. Yeah. And he's got lots and lots to say.
Well, we'll see what he has to say next week. And a reminder that we're there. You're going to be there, Jane, aren't you?
Mm-hmm.
And Stephen, have you got a train ticket up? Or are you... You're not TV.
I wouldn't want to air the MediaPod's dirty linen on your programme, but no, I haven't been invited. Someone's got to man the ship in London
to do all the boring stories. It's a very important
Thanks, boss.
It's a very important role. That's it for this week. Before we go, though, I must ask you, Stephen, in our regular end-of-podcast feature, what have you learned?
I've learned this week about Mihir Bose, the former BBC Sports News editor's new job.
Oh, that's very exciting. Now, tell us, is this a scoop? Is it a podcast scoop?
Yeah,
A Media Talk exclusive.
Yeah.
Where can he be going? He's not going to be... go on.
No,
I was going to go into a much more boring story.
He is going to write a weekly interview feature in the sports pages of the London Evening Standard.
I thought you were going to say the London paper. Oh, no. Damn. That's a weekly column that's not going to last very long. Excellent. Good on him. He's a good... You know, I know he wasn't that successful as a TV sports reporter, editor, but he's a good writer. Jane, what have you got to share with us?
Well, I can't really match that. But in talking to somebody about the Channel 4 chairmanship, which is about to be advertised in the pages of Media Guardian.
even better. Excellent. They're paying to advertise. Excellent. We're all safe for another week. I do feel another scoop coming on.
Well, the name, the first name I heard was that of Greg Dyke.
Just goes to show.
Can't keep a good man down.
Excellent.
Lazarus with a triple bypass.
Very good. Now, thank you very much. Thank you very much to the excellent Jane Martin and the ever glittering Stephen Brook.
Not quite so excellent.
No. I was trying to think of a positive adjective that wasn't better than excellent, but didn't make it sound too bad. To give your feedback on anything you've heard this week, post a comment on our blog, guardian.co.uk/mediatalk. Find us on Facebook. We're on Twitter, of course, as well. I'm Matt Wells. Thanks for listening. Goodbye.